Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, To Remember Axe Handle Saturday in Jacksonville, we'll revisit an interview with Rodney L. Hurst conducted in 2010 on the 50th anniversary of that event.
Jacksonville was quite a mess. It probably was not unlike other southern cities in terms of segregation.
We'll discuss Volusia County attorney and diplomat Bert Fish.
Fish was both politically ambitious and financially astute. The combination made him a rich man and elevated him to the national and international stage.
And we'll talk with Patsy West about her relationship with the Seminole. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Yeah!
On August 27, 1960, people from the African American community in Jacksonville gathered at the Laura Street Presbyterian Church and Youth Center to pray and sing We Shall Overcome. Many of those present fled to the church from downtown Jacksonville seeking sanctuary. Earlier in the day, more than 200 white people wielding axe handles and baseball bats began attacking black people in response to a peaceful lunch counter demonstration organized by the Jacksonville Youth Council of the NAACP. 16-year-old Rodney L. Hurst was president of the Jacksonville Youth Council and led sit-ins at white lunch counters in Woolworth's and W.T. Grant Department Store to protest racial segregation. Hurst has written a book about his experiences called It Was Never About a Hot Dog and a Coke. Rodney Hurst became involved in the civil rights movement at a very young age, inspired by a history teacher named Rutledge Pearson.
If you can imagine, as an eighth grader, and at the time I was 11 years old when I went to Mr. Pearson's class, and he would sit and he would explain to you about the American history book, and he would go through a spiel about the chapters and the pages and what's included in the book, and then he would tell the entire class, leave it home. And then he would proceed to break the class out into clusters, into groups and clusters, and then we would study American history. We would study persons, both contemporary and those who of days ago who were deceased. And every time we had a report to give, a group would give a report, and the rest of the class would have to take notes. And Mr. Pearson would ask questions after every presentation while we were taking notes. So it was an interactive class, and I'm talking 1955, 55 years ago I'm talking about. And as we talked about American history and as he gave us his insights and as we did out of the classroom research, then he would tell us freedom is not free. If you're not a part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And then he would encourage us to join the Youth Council NAACP, which we did. And you know, as you look back on those days and you follow, and as I've done many times from age 11 from his class through the NAACP days and what ultimately happened downtown and the aftermath, you understand plans. And we were all very spiritual, and I'm spiritual, and you understand that how much that was a part of God's plan to so fix things in such a way where the chronology happened the way it did. Mr. Pearson's definition of history was a narration of fact in chronological order with their cause and effect. And I often remember that definition, and I look back on those days as we were living through history at that time, and we were part of that narration, that chronological narration with the cause and effect.
The violence of Axe Handle Saturday did not occur in a vacuum. Racial segregation and overt racism had been building tension in Jacksonville. In his book, It Was Never About a Hot Dog and a Coke, Rodney L. Hurst places his personal story in the larger historical context of the civil rights movement and discusses specific aspects of segregation in Jacksonville. As Hurst explains, many people, both black and white, were uncomfortable promoting change.
Jacksonville was quite a mess. It probably was not unlike other southern cities in terms of segregation. Sit-in demonstrations and confronting the system and what we did, in some instances, was just a culmination of just a series of things. Naming a high school after Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Klan, all of that was part of it. Now, understand that Jacksonville's black community was not monolithic. So when we confronted the system, there were those who did not want us to do it. I didn't get into this a lot in the book, but I was a member of an Episcopal church. And there were those blacks who talked to members of the church to try to get my mother to make sure that I did not do some of the things that I was doing and later did. The whole concept of confronting the comfort level during that time made a lot of folk uncomfortable. Black folk and white folk. White folk, obviously, but black folk, because obviously if you don't stir up racial trouble, see, I got a nice little pat hand based on what I'm doing. There were some folks who were identified as conciliators who were on the payroll of the mayor of Jacksonville at that time. And they were black, and it was their responsibility to go out and make sure that there were no problems with black folk, you know. So you undercut and do whatever you need to do to keep that from happening. There were black churches, even though the black church was the backbone of the movement. But you still had black churches who did not support the movement and did not allow us to have mass meetings, and some of their ministers who spoke against some of the things we were doing. But in spite of, we still saw what we needed to do, and we did it.
Even though Rodney Hurst and the other members of the Jacksonville Youth Council of the NAACP were staging peaceful protests, the potential for violence was always present. The very limited newspaper coverage of Axe Handle Saturday says that the violence erupted because a white man named Richard Charles Parker joined the black students in their lunch counter demonstrations. Rodney Hurst disagrees.
The racists who were anti and who would hurl the racial epithets and who saw whites as being the nigger-loving agitators, they still would have done some things if Parker had not have been involved. I don't think that exacerbated or it speeded up some of the stuff they were going to do. 10 years ago, I met Clarence Sears, who was an informant for the FBI with the Klan, and he told us about the Klan having a meeting in a downtown Jacksonville hotel to make plans to start a race riot. So the Klan is the Klan, and you know, we can dress up the Ku Klux Klan any way we want to, but they represented violence in its starkest form, in its rawest form. It was cowardly violence because obviously many times it was done under a hood, but still it was violence nonetheless, and the intent was to scare, intimidate, and to bring physical harm. And that escalated from the axe handles and the baseball bats to shootings and ultimately to bombings. And many times you could not draw a line between the Klan and law enforcement, because law enforcement at least were accomplices to a lot of the things that the Klan did. And obviously now, 40, 50 years later, history bears that out based on just the member of law enforcement who were indicted for different crimes and who knew about some things and chose not to do anything. So it's just a series of things put us in those lunch counters and would not allow us to leave.
The book, It Was Never About a Hot Dog and a Coke, fills a void in Florida history. While largely a personal account from a participant's perspective, the book is augmented by research as well. Hurst says the research process was challenging due to a lack of extensive documentation of Axe Handle Saturday.
You would figure that, if nothing more, that there would be some kind of news-oriented or journalistic curiosity about what was happening at that time. Even if a story was cut or not carried in the newspaper, you still would figure that there would be some notes or something, but unfortunately nothing. the black press, it goes without saying the job that they did, because they really filled a void that the mainstream media just refused to fill. Now, correspondingly, there were many news reporters in Jacksonville, from outside of Jacksonville, from Chicago and New York and Washington and Atlanta and Orlando and Daytona Beach, Miami, Tampa, who covered what was happening here. And they might not have already got the story right. Their slanted views of reporting we might not have liked, but at least they covered the story. And that was something that the local media, news media, and print media did not do. And I think that that's something that I don't think they're proud of that. But nothing they can do about it now. I mean, that's just another part of history.
Rodney L. Hurst is National Chairman for the Association for the Study of African American Life and History 2024 Conference, to be held September 19th through 24th at the Hyatt Regency in Jacksonville. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series Florida Frontiers and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight. I'll say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in the 1930s, Volusia County played a prominent role in state politics, with David Schultz, a Daytona Beach attorney, serving as governor from 1933 to 1937, and Corey D. Landis of DeLand serving as Florida's Attorney General from 1931 to 1938. There was a third prominent Volusia County attorney whose name has become less recognizable, Bert Fish.
Sidney Johnston published an article, Bert Fish from Volusia County Courthouse to American Embassy, in the spring 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly, in which he argues that Bert Fish was indeed the third of the influential political figures from Volusia County, and perhaps the most important. As Johnston notes, Fish was a man of humble origins who began in the courtrooms of Central Florida, rose to prominence in the state Supreme Court and the National Democratic Party, and eventually became a significant member of America's diplomatic corps. Born in Indiana in 1875, the Fish family relocated to West Volusia County in 1880, where Bert's father planted a citrus grove. When his father died in 1892, the 17-year-old Bert began working as a store clerk and a school teacher to support his family. He also attended Stetson University, graduating from its academy in 1895 and the new law school in 1902. Fish was both politically ambitious and financially astute. The combination made him a rich man and elevated him to the national and international stage. He began with local politics and local economic opportunities. Even before he graduated from law school, he ran for the office of Volusia County Superintendent of Schools and won. In 1902, he opened his law practice and 6 years later was elected prosecuting attorney for the county. In 1910, he was appointed to fill the unexpired term of judge of the criminal court. Fish formed an advantageous law practice with his former professor and future attorney general, Cary Landis. The Landis and Fish firm practiced civil law, focusing on real estate, municipal bonding, and corporate law, a specialty that extended across Central Florida and provided the firm with, quote, a clientele of wealthy banks, large municipal governments, emerging public utilities, and regional railroads. Landis and Fish argued their first case before the Florida Supreme Court in 1906. By 1916, they had defended 27 cases before the state's highest court. Financially, Landis and Fish benefited from the state's growth. In 1903, they purchased and incorporated the Volusia County Abstract Company. Johnston outlined the investments. Over the next years, Fish acquired 6 commercial buildings, 2 hotels, and several citrus groves spread across Flagler, Pinellas, Seminole, and St. John's counties. During the land boom, he invested in speculative housing developments, including Daytona Gardens and Harbor Point subdivisions. With their wealth and political connections, Landis and Fish became powerful political forces in West Volusia County, and in the process, made equally powerful political enemies. Fish lost a bid for the state Senate in 1916, in which his opponents characterized him as, quote, a political boss who as judge exercised monstrous power with all the money he wanted, personally doling out patronage in Volusia County. Although not in office, Landis and Fish remained powerful enough to block a 1917 effort by East Volusia County to divide the large county into 2 entities, and thereby launched a decades-long political rivalry between David Schultz and Fish.
Connie, the election of Schultz to the governorship in 1932 must have roiled Volusia County politics even further.
As Johnston notes of the election results, quote, 2 of Volusia County's ranking politicians and bitter opponents, Schultz and Landis, found themselves working together in the highest levels of government. That election also weakened the Landis-Fish political bloc in West Volusia County, as some Democrats from the western part of the county defected from the party ticket to vote for Republican candidates for the Volusia County Council. Factionalism in 1936 and 1940 elections further diminished the power of Landis and Fish. For Bert Fish, however, the 1932 election launched a new career. Parlaying his relationship with George B. Hills, a Jacksonville civil engineer and close friend to Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Democratic candidate for president, to secure a position as finance director for the Florida National Campaign. Fish speedily moved from state to national politics with not a small amount of irritation and sniping by upper-level state politicos.
Having an inside track into the Roosevelt administration must have opened new opportunities for political advancement for Fish.
Raising money to elect presidential candidates to office is frequently rewarded with ambassador appointments, and Fish was no exception. Johnson notes that Fish's preference was to be appointed governor of Puerto Rico, followed by ambassador to Cuba, minister to Turkey, and finally minister to Egypt. Roosevelt made 3 appointments from Florida. Robert Gore of Fort Lauderdale became governor of Puerto Rico. Ruth Bryant Owen, daughter of William Jennings Bryant, was appointed minister to Denmark, and Bert Fish was named minister to Egypt. Fish arrived in Egypt at a sensitive moment in that nation's history. World War I and the promise of democracy, promoted at the Versailles Treaty negotiations, spoke to long-festering discontent under British imperialism. As Johnston explains, quote, a rebellion in 1919, the formation of Egypt's liberal constitutional party in the early 1920s, and the rise of Benito Mussolini in Italy prompted the British government to reevaluate its policies toward Egypt, loosening the administrative and taxation system onerously known as Egypt's capitulation regime, end quote. In 1937, acting on Secretary of State Cordell Hull's instructions to, quote, adopt a sympathetic and liberal attitude toward the aspirations of the Egyptian government, end quote, Fish asserted Egypt's right and ability to govern itself. This statement prompted the British ambassador, Sir Miles Lampson, to ask, quote, is that the American delegate speaking or the Egyptian delegate, end quote. Fish is credited with helping to initiate a new treaty that was signed on May 8, 1937. Egypt, the Suez Canal, and the region's oil reserves became increasingly important as the world moved toward war. In 1939, Roosevelt appointed Fish as the first U.S. diplomat to Saudi Arabia. In accepting this appointment, Fish also became the first to hold 2 appointments simultaneously. His assignment was to establish consular relations in order to protect American oil interests in the kingdom. His mission became more urgent after the invasion of Poland in 1939. Fish succeeded in launching formal diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia that continue today.
Connie, for a person who was not a career diplomat, Fish had an impressive number of successes. World War II could have brought a number of new challenges to his Egyptian mission.
The war did bring new challenges for Fish, but not in Egypt. In mid-1940, he requested a reassignment, preferably to Turkey. Roosevelt praised his work in Egypt, but sent him to Portugal instead. Johnston interprets the move to Portugal as evidence of, quote, the increasing confidence the Roosevelt administration placed in him as a diplomat, noting that some observers ranked Great Britain, Portugal, and Romania as the top three European diplomatic posts with crucial war importance. Portugal was a neutral country, but it possessed strategic military bases and war material. The American diplomat in place had to negotiate the fine line of defending U.S. interests without offending Portuguese positions. American pilots landed their crippled aircraft in Portugal and sought repatriation to the U.S. The Azores Islands, under the control of Portugal, were strategically important to Allied strategy. Portugal was also the leading source of wolfram, a critical war need. Fish obtained a treaty securing 50% of the Portuguese output of wolfram, a source of tungsten. He had limited success in securing landing rights in the Azores, but he negotiated for the release of American pilots who landed in Portugal. The work he had done on behalf of the United States took a toll on his health. Following a brief illness, Fish died of a heart attack in Lisbon on July 21, 1943. He was given a state funeral and buried in the English cemetery in Lisbon. Later that year, his body was disinterred and reburied in DeLand's Oakland Cemetery. He made two sizable bequests, one to his alma mater, Stetson University, and the second to establish a trust fund to construct hospitals in DeLand, New Smyrna Beach, and Sanford. As Johnston concludes, a seasoned diplomat, Fish endeared himself to the Egyptians, allayed the fears of the Saudis, and prepared the stage for constructive United States-Portugal relations. An untimely death left unfulfilled the dreams and ambitions of a small-town Florida attorney and American statesman to achieve still greater posts and objectives in international affairs.
And the Burt Fish Collection is housed in the Stetson University Archives and is available to researchers. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
We can work it out. We can work it out.
This is Florida Frontiers. Patsy West is an ethnohistorian who has spent her career with the Seminole. Holly Baker has more.
I recently spoke with ethnohistorian Patsy West. For over 50 years, she's collaborated with the Seminole and Miccosukee tribes on publications and projects encompassing some 250 years of tribal history, culture, and art. She's also the author of several books, including The Enduring Seminoles, From Alligator Wrestling to Ecotourism. Patsy West is a fourth-generation Floridian whose family's been intertwined with the Seminole tribe of Florida for over 130 years. That relationship inspired her to dedicate her life to preserving their history and culture.
We lived in Gainesville, just south of Gainesville, in Marion County. We had come down with the entire family, including my great-great-great-grandmother, because they wanted to raise oranges. But my great-granddad realized before any of the freezes that it could ruin them easily. So they sold off, packed up everything, and left by boat from Tampa to go down to the Miami area.
In 1878, William Freeman, Patsy West's great-grandfather, arrived with his family to the Miami area and became a homesteader and tomato farmer.
And he was known by the scientific community as William Freeman of Little River because he was tuned into the environment like nobody else at that time. And so when people would come down either to purchase land or whatever, he'd take them around and show them the best places. They would ask questions about, well, what's the best crop or whatever. And he paid attention to the birds, to the bugs, the rodents, you know, everything.
In 1888, Patsy West's grandmother, Ethel, was born on Little River, near Lemon City. The Freeman homestead, Built in 1892 out of Dade County pine, functioned as a trading post with the local Seminoles, who soon became dear friends to the family. Patsy West grew up hearing stories from her grandmother about the family's friendship with the Seminoles and her memories of Pine Island.
Pine Island in the Everglades is 2.5 miles long. It's an island that my family knew 130 years ago. The people that lived there would come to our place in Little River, Miami, and they were my great-granddad's best friends. He hunted with them. He stepped masts in their canoes. He was good friends with them. We were close enough that in 1892, we had a photographer living with us, and Otto Sonstebo, a Norwegian, and he took glass negative photographs. So when I first started life at the History Museum in Miami as curator, I took one of our family pictures out to Buffalo Tiger, who was then the chairman of the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida on the Tamiami Trail. And I remember I said, "Chairman Tiger, these are your relatives from 1892 sitting in our yard." And I pointed to some. I said, "This is your great-grandmother. This probably one of these four little girls is one of them is your mother." And we became friends to his death in the late 80s.
Patsy West's family's close relationship with the Seminole tribe inspired her to accumulate an archive of photographs with materials from private and public sources. She first began organizing a comprehensive collection of Seminole and Miccosukee photographs in 1972 while working as the curator at the Historical Museum of Southern Florida in Miami. Since then, the archive has been a valuable visual and historical resource. Patsy West's book, Seminole and Miccosukee Tribes of Southern Florida, contains photographs from the Seminole Miccosukee Archive, which contains over 11,000 images dating from 1852 to the present day. Patsy West.
That's when I started the Seminole Photographic Archive. I started that because we had a new Xerox machine. It was gigantic. And I could photocopy the images that we had in 3 files in the museum. And that was the entree for me to set up a table at Seminole Fair. They let me in for free because I wasn't selling anything, and have people come in and identify the photocopies in these books. And that is actually how I began life. So that was great because there was at that time a very strong reticence because people always wanted something. They never wanted to give, they just wanted something from the people. And so I would have really old people at my booth and we became friends, and that was 50 years ago. My grandmother was born in 1888 and she told me bedtime stories, and I don't think I had a choice of what I would do when I grew up. I was an art history major at Florida State, but when I came home, I pretty much started with the people, and I've been with them ever since.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.